the court doesn't retain its legitimate function of interpreting the Constitution, I'm not sure who would take up that mantle. You don't want the political branches telling you what the law is, and you don't want public opinion to be the guide of what the appropriate decision is. So, yes, all of our opinions are open to criticism. In fact, our members do a great job of criticizing some opinions from time to time. But simply because people disagree with an opinion is not a basis for questioning the legitimacy of the court.
Chief Justice John Roberts last month defending the institution and his fellow Supreme Court justices after a monumental term that saw the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the expansion of gun rights, and the erosion of separation of church and state and the EPA's ability to deal with climate change. Just some minor issues. The new term begins today, and the newest justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, took the bench for the first time. She'll be part of arguments and cases that could make this term just as important as last year's. There's a voting rights case that could determine how the 2024 election might unfold, giving states unheard-of powers to decide the outcome. And the court is primed to weaken the legal protections against discrimination in colleges and universities and at the ballot box. That is according to my next guest and Press Play's Legal Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. She joins us most Mondays with her analysis. Hello.
Happy first day of the Supreme Court term.
Wow. Is this your favorite day of the year? Is this
It is. Like I have to. We were actually on my birthday last time because there were some big Supreme Court decisions. It comes typically on the last day of the term. Uh-huh. But with this year, I have to be honest, I approach the term with some dread, and I'm sure we'll talk about those cases.
Okay, we will talk about those cases. Let's talk about what happened today. They heard arguments in a pretty consequential case for the environment, Sackett v. Environmental Protection Agency. This is about the Clean Water Act. So give us the details, the summary at least, on this case.
So it's basically about how much does the Clean Water Act actually cover? How much power does the federal government have to regulate people's waterways? And I listened to part of the oral arguments this morning, in part in preparation for our conversation, in part because I was so curious to see how now Justice Jackson poses her questions. And you saw basically all of the justices really animated about questions like, well, if a waterway is abuts a river, but is not adjacent to the river, does this still include something that we could say is covered by the Clean Water Act? So it's these kinds of questions, which in a lot of ways, the justices are not particularly well suited to determine what these agencies should be able to do and remedy. But in some ways they are, because this is the job of a judge to try and determine mm-hmm. what these words mean and what's covered by the words. And of course it follows on a case that we talked about perhaps on my birthday last term, dealing with the EPA and how much power the EPA has to regulate, to try and curb climate change. All of this is basically a theme of how much power do these federal agencies have in order to try and remedy really potential environmental disasters.
Right. So as you mentioned, the court did limit the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. They could do it with wetlands in this case. And did they signal any way they might go?
So I actually heard a lot of the justices this morning, and you always need to be careful about what you hear in oral arguments, but basically think that there could be the power under the Clean Water Act to, in fact, regulate at least the wetlands as this case comes up to them. So that would be good news, I think, for a lot of environmental activists, a lot of people who are concerned about the federal government's power really being whittled away. Now, again, we have to see who writes the opinion, how it's written, but I heard a lot of skepticism about the challenger's position here and why they wouldn't be covered, why the federal government wouldn't be able to act.
Okay. All right. Tomorrow, the court is going to hear oral arguments in a really big voting rights case out of Alabama. So set this one up for us.
Really big case. So basically, Alabama, like all other states, redrew their legislative district lines, including their House of Representative lines, after the 2020 census with the new data that was available. In Alabama, Black people are about 27% of the state population. But the way the lines were drawn, it put Black voters as a majority in only one district, one of seven. That's 14% of the districts. So they would have the power to pick the candidate of their choosing really in about half of the districts as is commensurate with their population, meaning 14% of the districts, but they're 27% of the population. Now, the lower court looked at this and they said, oh, this is an unconstitutional and violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. This is an impermissible racial gerrymander. It clearly packs all of the Black voters into one district and then impermissibly disperses them into the other districts. So they can't get that majority. They can't create a voting coalition. Now, Alabama challenged this. They went up to the Supreme Court and they said, we need emergency relief. We don't want to redraw the lines. The Supreme Court took what I think is a really extraordinary step. And they actually said, okay, we are going to let the district lines that the this three-judge panel thought violated the Voting Rights Act, we're going to let those stand and wait until we can hear the case. That, to me, signals exactly where the Supreme Court is going here.
Well, they're going to hear the case tomorrow. So could they issue an emergency injunction, if you will, or an emergency order before the midterms, or will they not do that until the spring?
So they could. I will say that would hugely surprise me, given that they decided to basically let Alabama roll with what I think are House of Representative lines that violate federal law and told them, just wait until we can hear the case. That was months ago. So I would be surprised if suddenly, based on really no new information, they decide that they need to act very quickly. I think this is more of what we've seen from the court, which is we're going to see them really whittle away at the last remaining part of the Voting Rights Act that stands as protection against things like racial gerrymandering and vote dilution. And the big issue legally is when it comes to a challenge for the Voting Rights Act, do you have to show that there's a discriminatory effect, which is what I think the law currently requires, or discriminatory intent, which is much more difficult and would basically make those cases, frankly, all but impossible to win.
Interesting. All right. So moving on to, we just have to keep marching through because we don't have that much time. There's so many big cases. But speaking of voting, this is a case out of North Carolina that would also be related to legislative maps. And this time, in this case, the state court struck down the districts as illegally gerrymandered. Republicans in North Carolina are arguing against that, saying that there is this idea known as the independent state legislature theory. First of all, what is that?
What is it? I know this is a theory that really the breadcrumbs of this theory first began actually in the Bush v. Gore separate opinions. And the idea dates back to language in the Constitution. There's two parts of the Constitution, and they talk about state legislatures determining the time, place, and manner of federal elections, and state legislatures having power over basically which electors are sent to the Electoral College. And that has never been understood to literally just mean state lawmakers. It has always been understood that state court judges have a role, like they did just now in the North Carolina case, where they said these lines violate the North Carolina Constitution. Now, the theory would essentially allow, in this case, for state lawmakers to have the last word when it comes to things like drawing district lines or even voter ID laws or ballot designs or polling places when it comes to federal elections. Because if state legislatures really just mean state lawmakers, then the state court judges have no say. They can't check the power of state lawmakers. It would also have implications, of course, for the Electoral College and which slate of electors are being sent. We heard about that a lot when it came to the scheme to send fake electors to the counting of the Electoral College votes in 2020. So this, to me, if the court wants to go big, it would entirely upend our understanding of how we conduct federal elections and the power of state lawmakers.
So if the court does side with North Carolina in this, they could essentially say, look, you, or state legislatures is what you're saying, in other states could potentially say, well, look, we can send an alternate slate of electors because the courts have no, the state courts do not have jurisdiction over us in this particular manner.
With the caveat that federal court judges would still have a say if there are federal law issues. And there might be some federal law issues with that particular plan. But yes, it would mean that state court judges would have no ability to say that violates our state constitution or that violates state law. And as we've been talking about, federal judges and their power to basically police overreaching when it comes to elections is being whittled away by the Supreme Court. So federal judges aren't acting as the safety valve, frankly, that they used to.
Okay. We have just about a minute left, but I want to get to affirmative action. There are a pair of cases the Supreme Court will hear at the end of the month. And could they, in effect, say that colleges and universities do not have to have affirmative action policies?
Yes, and they will. I can be really quick on this one. So there are two different cases. One comes from Harvard, one comes from the University of North Carolina. That's specifically designed because we want a private university, Harvard, and that brings up issues of federal law, and a public university, the University of North Carolina, that brings up questions of the Constitution and the Equal Protection Clause. The punchline here is that this was settled law as of 2003. Justice O'Connor wrote an opinion that said race can be one factor that's considered to create a more diverse student body. But there's no one in that five-person majority that's currently still on the court. And so the court decided to take these cases again. I don't see any reason that you take the cases unless you want to say affirmative action programs in higher education are unconstitutional.
Jessica Levinson is our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. She teaches at Loyola Law School, and we will be talking about these cases in much more detail as the term progresses. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, you will soon be able to jaywalk legally in California. We'll have that story. Plus, the churn at late night comedy shows next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Go ahead, cross the street wherever you want, middle of the block, red light, but no cars coming. Go right ahead. That radical act of jaywalking will not be a crime as of January 1st next year. Governor Gavin Newsom just signed a law that decriminalizes jaywalking after activists argue that people of color are more likely to be ticketed. Jaywalking has been illegal in California since the 1930s, so nearly 100 years, as cars became ubiquitous back then. For more on this, let's bring in Peter Norton. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Virginia's Department of Engineering and Society. Hello there.
It's great to be on Press Play.
Well, it's great to have you on Press Play. And let's talk about the word jaywalking. Where did that come from?
Well, when people first started to drive cars in cities or to try to sell them, one of their big frustrations was people walking wherever they wanted, which was at that time what streets were for. So they needed a way to sort of pressure people to give up their right to the street. And Jay was a good word for that because Jay was a very insulting term, meaning a hick or somebody from the country with no education who doesn't know what to do in the city.
So that they would just wander around in the streets getting hit by cars.
That was the image of them that the people who wanted to sell cars wanted to make. They wanted to make this look like a foolish act when, from the point of view of the people walking, all they were doing is what streets had always been used for.
Yeah. Well, so how effective are jaywalking laws, or were they, in preventing pedestrian accidents or fatalities?
Well, I want to start by saying I'm not sure they were ever primarily intended to protect pedestrians. There's better ways to protect pedestrians. But the thing is, if you want a world where you can drive fast through a city, then you do have to restrict pedestrians. And so if you have to have fast driving in a city, then you have to restrict pedestrians to some degree. But there are other ways to protect pedestrians that work very well in other places around the world. One of them is just to make spaces where drivers have to slow down.
Mm-hmm. So you go to New York City and the walker rules, right? You can jaywalk all over the place and the traffic is really slow. And here it's the opposite. Are we getting to that point, do you think, in other cities like Los Angeles, where the rights for the walker will become preeminent?
Well, I think we have to head in that direction because we need a more sustainable future where you can get around with less fuel burned. And so New York is setting an example. It might look like a chaotic example, but a lot of people can walk in New York. They walk not only because they can walk on the sidewalk, but because the subways and the buses also help them as walkers to make destinations more close together. And so if the future is a more sustainable future, that's an example of how to do it.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I didn't realize this was such a politically charged law, or there was so much history that was politically charged. And speaking of, one of the reasons why the governor signed this was because jaywalking citations are disproportionately handed down to people of color and people in low-income communities. Is that the case elsewhere?
Yes, it's been the case throughout this country in particular, where race and class are thoroughly intertwined. And, you know, the class distinction was obvious from the beginning because in the early days of the automobile, it was for high-income people only. As that began to change, it more and more became a ubiquitous thing, but the automobile still is an expensive burden for a lot of people. And also, the rules are inequitable in the sense that you're absolutely right. All over the country, jaywalking laws have in particular fallen hard on the people who have to walk the most. And even among people who have to walk a lot, they fall disproportionately on people of color.
Mm. Okay, so you said that earlier that it would be safer for pedestrians if cars slowed down. What are some other ways to make walking safer? Here in Los Angeles, it is particularly dangerous to be walking the streets.
Well, slowing cars down really is the key thing to do. Everything else is an extra on top of that. And once you make an environment where people can walk safely and conveniently to practical destinations like a grocery store or something like that, then you make neighborhoods that are also more attractive to a lot of people. Retail and business tends to improve, and even driving can become more convenient as more and more people who would have been driving in an environment hostile to walkers start walking or riding a bike or taking the bus instead. So it can be beneficial to more than just the people who are actually walking.
Okay. Maybe we should redefine the term. Jaywalking, I didn't realize it was so pejorative. Maybe there's a nicer term for it.
Well, I mean, a lot of the critics of the term say that the right word is walking. And calling it jaywalking it's just denormalizing a very normal activity. That was a very common criticism early on. And California was the real trendsetter here. It had the first effective no jaywalking law passed in Los Angeles in January 1925.
Mm, okay. Well, we are taking the radical step of getting rid of that. This Peter Norton, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Peter Norton is an associate professor of history at the University of Virginia's Department of Engineering and Society. Well, if you tuned into the season premiere of Saturday Night Live this weekend, you probably noticed several of the veteran cast members were not there. So many were missing. In fact, they joked about it in the show's cold open.
What the hell was that?
The governor of South Dakota. A political impression that no one asked for. What about a fun impression like Anthony Fauci or Lindsey Graham or Rudy Giuliani?
Yeah, well, those are all Kate McKinnon.
Damn.
Well, she's one of the cast members who left, and SNL isn't the only late-night favorite in flux. Last week, Trevor Noah announced plans to leave his job hosting The Daily Show.
And I realized that after the 7 years, my time is up. But in the most beautiful way.
That's in addition to James Corden's plan to exit the Late Late Show next year. All these high-profile departures are changing the landscape of late-night TV. Joining us to talk about it is Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR and friend of Press Play. Hello.
I treasure that title. I do.
Good. I'm glad. Okay, so what did you think of SNL, the season premiere? Did you watch it?
I watched it. I reviewed it for NPR.org. Please check it out if you like.
Okay, definitely.
I basically said it felt like a throat clearing exercise. Like, these were a bunch of mostly mediocre skits that seemed sort of to be about assessing what the cast could do, where their strengths were, what they might be able to tackle, and what might be tougher for them to handle. They lost a lot of talented mimics, for example.
Kate McKinnon, for example.
McKinnon and Melissa Villaseñora. I mean, you know, she's one of those impressionists who had like 50, you know, impressions up her sleeve. And A.D. Bryant did some really cool impersonations, you know, Ted Cruz and people like that. So Wynonna Judd. So they lost a lot of mimics. So somebody the guy who is playing Trump now, James Austin Johnson, you know, became more important. And indeed, you know, he played three people on Saturday. He played Trump and Mitch McConnell and Armie Hammer. And they also seemed to lean more on Bowen Yang and Kenan Thompson, who are, you know, Kenan's, you know, one of the most veteran performers, and Bowen is somebody who's been pretty reliable at getting laughs. So, you know, they seem to be kind of filling themselves out and filling out, you know, where's the talent, who's going to step up, you know, what can they do and what can't they do now with this new group of people?
Right. And I guess they've had their ups and downs throughout their long career of people leaving and coming, and SNL.
It's always, you know, that's the truism for Saturday Night Live. And you know, Lorne Michaels, a longtime executive producer, tried to explain it by saying that, you know, the pandemic and the shutdowns made it harder for some veteran cast members to leave when maybe they might have left last year or the year before, because it just weren't, you know, things weren't in production. Mm-hmm. And the show kind of seemed to need their efforts because they tried to come back almost before anybody. So now that is all kind of eased, you know, maybe it's, you know, some people who were going to leave a while ago decided to leave now. That may be true, but there have been some involuntary dismissals in there too. You know, I think some people were surprised to not come back. And we even had one, you know, Chris Redd, that was announced way after everybody else, everybody else's departures were announced. So I think it's a combination of they wanted to change things up, but then they wound up having to let go of more people than maybe
they wanted to. Okay, let's move on to The Daily Show. It was a surprise, I think, to even people behind the scenes that, you know, on his show, that Trevor Noah called it quits.
It definitely was a surprise. I can definitely say that based on my reporting.
Okay, so what happened? He just went out there and thought, hey, you know what? I think I'll quit today.
Well, I think, I don't know, I'm sure that he put a lot of thought into it, but he didn't tell many people at the show or anybody at Comedy Central that I'm aware of.
Wow.
And in fact, you know, there was some sense that he had kind of agreed to keep doing the show. He had kind of agreed to some contract extensions earlier in the year. So there was a little surprise that he decided to make that announcement the way he did and make it now.
So what is he going to do? Do we know?
Well, you know, I think it was the Hollywood Reporter had a story about that he makes a lot of money touring. He's, you know, he's one of those guys where he might not be a huge name in stand-up comedy in America, but outside of America, you know, he sells out stadiums. He has a popular and lucrative stand-up comedy career. And also, you know, he's been dabbling in being an executive producer. I'm sure he wants to try being an actor. I'm sure, you know, people, given his facility with accents and mimicry, it seems like it would be a natural for him to try acting, but he hasn't been able to do a lot of that stuff because he's the sole star of a show that airs, you know, 4 new episodes a week, most weeks. And, you know, I was surprised that Comedy Central didn't try to work something out where maybe he would work fewer days in a week and maybe they would have, I mean, you know, if I wanted to keep Trevor, I would have said, you know, maybe you work 3 days a week and we'll have somebody like Roy Wood Jr., one of the correspondents that are popular, have them host the show 1 or 2 days a week. But
it sounds like they didn't know he was going to do that. So,
well, they didn't know he was going to quit. Yeah. You know, even in some of my reporting, I did get the sense that they were aware that, you know, the grind of the show was an issue for him and that, you know, there may have been some talk about trying to deal with that. Mm-hmm. But
we're going to have to wrap now. Speaking of the grind of the show, we have to grind on.
Sure. Sorry about that.
Eric Deggans, TV critic for NPR. Always great to have you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the surprising strength of Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro.
Bolsonaro is strong. We have 4 more weeks. I do think a Lula win is still the most likely outcome, but it's going to be close.
There will be a runoff at the end of the month. Until then, intense campaigning. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Brazil's 2 most prominent and polarizing politicians are heading to a runoff in the race to be the next president. The far-right incumbent, President Jair Bolsonaro, and leftist former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, or just Lula. Neither received the 50% needed to claim victory. Lula came out ahead with 48% of the vote, but Bolsonaro performed better than polls said he would. And now an intense and messy campaign for the final vote on October 30th begins. Joining us to talk about this is Andre Pagliarini. He's a professor of Latin American history at Hampden Sydney College and a fellow at the think tank, the Washington Brazil office. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think everyone was really surprised that Bolsonaro did so well, given the fact that polls had him so far behind. What happened?
Yeah, so we're still sort of puzzling through all of this, but I think we can say a few things. Namely, as you said, the polls were pretty good when it came to Lula's numbers. There was a realistic prospect that he could win outright. So that was pretty much correct. He ended up with about 48. Where the polls really missed, though, were Bolsonaro's numbers. He far exceeded, as you said, his ceiling of support. And this is baffling in part because the Bolsonaro administration has presided over a series of disasters for Brazil, whether it be the COVID-19 pandemic, deforestation in the Amazon. I think one of the things that's really we'll have to consider is that there are plenty of people, given all of this baggage, who simply wouldn't tell pollsters that they were going to support him.
Mm. So why wouldn't they do that? Why would they be potentially embarrassed to tell them that they favored Bolsonaro?
Yeah, well, you know, the idea that this is a president who has become, in the eyes of the world, a pariah, who even in Brazil, there was a real sense of momentum that Lula was on the march and that this broad front that the former president had put together would prevail, that this might have disencouraged people to sort of advertise their support for Bolsonaro. Of course, he has a very strong core of support, but what we saw was a real swing in the final days. So, you know, we don't really quite know, but I do think at least a big chunk of that are people who were either not reached by the polls or who simply didn't tell the polls what they were really intending to do in the ballot box.
And are they in particular places in the country, particular demographic groups?
So primarily the left does well in the Northeast. Lula's originally from the Northeast. The southeast of the country, so places like São Paulo, Rio, these are generally speaking more conservative parts of the country. And what looked like was going to happen heading into this round of voting was that the left would do better than it has historically has done in that part of the country, in the southeast. So Lula's party, the Workers' Party, the candidate for governor in São Paulo, for example, was leading in the polls against the chosen candidate of Bolsonaro. Last night showed a real different scenario. Bolsonaro's candidate far outperformed the Workers' Party candidate in São Paulo. There will be a runoff there as well. So I think part of what we saw is that the parts of the country that the right usually does well in, that the polls showed Lula making serious inroads, reverted back to sort of what might have been expected, which is a strong showing for conservative candidates in the southeast of the country. Mm.
So that's really interesting. It's not just the power of the personality when it comes to Bolsonaro. It is in these parts of the country that you're talking about an attachment to an entire slate of conservative candidates.
Yes. And the thing about Bolsonarismo, which is the movement that has coalesced around the president, is that it really has displaced the sort of traditional center right. So, for example, in the state of São Paulo, which is Brazil's largest, most prosperous state, that state has been governed for almost 28 years, almost 30 years, by a center right party. It's called the Party of Brazilian Social Democracy, that didn't even make the runoff. It's a party that has been completely decimated in the wake of Bolsonaro's rise, a much harder right wing displacing a kind of moderate right wing. So in a multi-party system like Brazil, there are different political forces, different parties, but it's not entirely dissimilar to what we saw in this country, mm-hmm. where there's a far right faction that has kind of elbowed out a more moderate center right faction. And the most recent results really exemplify that.
Well, speaking of former President Trump, Bolsonaro has been compared to him in many ways, including his COVID response, but also with election fraud conspiracies. And so has he said, if he loses, that he will cede to Lula, or will he contest the election if he loses?
Almost uniformly, he has said if he doesn't win, something went wrong. In fact, when he was in London recently for Queen Elizabeth's funeral, he said, I've been traveling the country. I'm getting really good response from the voters. If I don't win outright, he said, in the first round, something is fishy. Now, none of the polls had him anywhere near the lead, let alone an outright victory. But absolutely, the same Trump tactic of laying the groundwork to contest. There was one time that I can think of where he seemed to reckon with the possibility of defeat. He said, if I lose, I will leave the stage and I'll go home. And I've done all I wanted to do in national political life and I will leave. But every other answer has been, if I don't win, something is fishy.
So what does that mean as we watch the campaign move forward to the final vote? Do you expect that rhetoric to ramp up and for there to be possible violence?
So what I've argued is that for anyone committed to democracy and sort of peace, social peace, the best outcome would have been a Lula outright victory. Because what we're going to see now is an extension of the campaign. This is a campaign that's already been marked by political violence from Bolsonaro supporters. And now we have four more weeks of it. And we have a Bolsonarista camp that is certainly emboldened, that will say, see, the polls were wrong. We are here. We are strong. And so I think this is the worst possible outcome for Brazil because Bolsonaro is strong. We have four more weeks. I do think a Lula win is still the most likely outcome, but it's going to be close. And I really worry about the situation in the country.
And then if Lula wins, how will he govern if so many of the members of Congress are from the right wing or in the far right wing?
This is a real challenge. The Congress and the Senate that it looks like he will have to work with if and when he is inaugurated is so far to the right that negotiations will be difficult. He might well come into office on January 1st, 2023, if he wins, as something of a lame duck, or else someone who has to cede so much of his agenda that it might be difficult to really envision a progressive government worthy of that title. So it's a real challenge.
Well, thank you so much for updating us.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Andre Pagliarini. He's a professor of Latin American history at Hampden Sydney College in Virginia. Coming up, we'll meet the first all-female heavy metal band in Lebanon, Slave to Sirens, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The new documentary, Sirens, follows a group of young women making music history in Lebanon.
In a small soundproof rehearsal room in the mountain just outside Beirut, Lebanon's first all-female metal band, Slave to Sirens, is getting ready to make some noise.
That's the guitarist, Sherry Bashara. She's a member of the band Slave to Sirens, and they're celebrating the band's first magazine feature a few years ago. There she is reading from that feature. The film follows these five women as they try to make their thrash metal band a success in a Muslim country that doesn't much care for their music. And in a country that is crumbling. The economy is in ruins. There are mass protests against government corruption. Joining me now is Rita Baghdadi. She's the director of Sirens. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, you begin your movie with scenes from some of these mass protests from the October Revolution that began in 2019. Describe what the conditions are in Lebanon. What are people protesting against?
People are protesting against largely government corruption. The country of Lebanon has just been in crisis for so long. I mean, generations, decades of, you know, civil war and just issues along their borders and, you know, government mismanagement, economic decline, in fact, hyperinflation, economic crisis. The whole country is in under capital control, so they can't take their own money out of the banks. There's a lot going on. And then once, you know, the explosion hit, then there's that as well.
Right. So this explosion, if people don't remember, happened in 2020 at a port, and it killed more than 200 people. Thousands of others lost their homes. And it really was an epical moment for Lebanon because the explosion happened due to government corruption, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the jury is still out about actually who's to blame, but basically it was a mismanaged storage of tons of ammonium nitrate that just sat in the port and one day essentially caught on fire and exploded, which I think it's the third largest explosion ever in human history, in fact.
Oh my gosh. Wow. And so, and this is during the pandemic too. So
right.
Lebanon had to deal with that as well.
Yeah. A lot. We had to navigate a serious number of catastrophic events during filming Sirens.
Oh, my gosh. Well, let me play a clip from the other main character, Lilas, when she's talking about the explosion and just how she feels about it in the context of the history of Lebanon.
We inherited some kind of trauma from our parents. I wasn't aware of it. Until this explosion happened, it just... I started imagining that the water around in Beirut is filled with dead bodies. People are still missing. Home doesn't feel safe. Friendship doesn't feel safe. Love doesn't feel safe.
That is really poignant. Tell us more about Lilas. Who is she?
Lilas is someone that I immediately identified with when I met her. It felt like I'd known her all along, like she was my younger sister. She's a very talented self-taught musician. When we first started filming, she was 23 years old. So she's a young woman, you know, coming into her own in a generation of Lebanon who has been, you know, her parents were seriously traumatized by the civil war. And so grew up sort of in a sheltered way, I should say, you know, a lot of fear around growing up at that time. And so her form of self-expression is metal music, and she uses her guitar playing and her band as her way to channel her anger for, you know, the country and for her people and everything that she's had to deal with.
And the other main character is Sherry. The two of them had a romantic relationship. They're very close. And tell us more about Sherry and how she navigates Lebanon's culture, its history, and what's happening in the country.
Yeah, Sherry is a really sensitive, creative individual who, again, uses guitar as her form of self-expression. In the film, you learn, you know, she has trouble sort of expressing herself, you know, telling people how she feels. And so music is her way of navigating the world and her emotions.
I feel misunderstood a lot. Without music, I don't know how to express how I feel. I don't know what I'm feeling. Is it fear? Or is it dreams? What is she looking for?
Her and Lilas founded the band Slave to Sirens together in 2015. They met at a protest. And from then, they were, you know, sort of inseparable, creating this band together, finding the other members, and creating the music. You know, in metal music, guitar is a real driver of the songs. And so as Sherry is the lead guitarist and Lilas is the rhythm guitarist, they really work together to make magic happen. And as you can imagine, along the way, there's a lot of creative differences, and there's a, you know, push and pull about how to manage the band and just, you know, again, coming of age, being that age in your life where everything is changing for you and you're really trying to forge your own identity.
Yeah. And I guess that happens a lot in bands, that there are disagreements and sometimes band members leave and sometimes they come back. And that indeed is what happens. So it's almost like a rock and roll cliche in a way that they have this tempestuous situation where Sherry leaves the band.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is inevitable that there's going to be creative differences. But, you know, with this film, while I was filming it, I really saw there was, you know, there's a lot more under the surface. You know, there's a lot of feelings, as Sherry says, that go unspoken. A lot of things that happened that, you know, they never talked about and that maybe the rest of the band didn't know about. So I would say it goes one layer deeper than just the sort of creative differences cliche.
So the other members of the band, the other three, didn't know that they were in a relationship?
They were never actually in a relationship, but yes, you're right. They hid their experience together from the rest of the bandmates.
Right. Well, so what is it like to be queer in Beirut? Can you be out in the open?
You know, it really depends on your personal situation. I mean, though the country itself, there is a law, Article 534, which we talk about briefly in the film. It's vague. It criminalizes homosexuality, but the wording around it, you know, calls for an interpretation of the laws of nature, quote unquote. So, you know, historically being LGBT in the Middle East is against, you know, it's taboo. And it really depends on your personal situation, whether, you know, you can be comfortable being out or not. But largely as a country, no. I mean, I think things are getting worse, unfortunately.
Hmm. And how does Sherry and Lilas feel about it with their families? Do they feel comfortable coming out in front of their families?
No, I think there's a lot of discomfort around it. I think it's a really delicate matter. And, you know, with Lilas specifically, we're working to support her in her journey It's been a complex process. But, you know, I think it really comes down to safety and feeling the security of one's family unit. And that gets put on the line when you go against the norms.
Yeah. Lilas and her mother have a very close yet fraught relationship. And as you said earlier, her parents were really traumatized by the Civil War. How does she negotiate her relationship with her mother? Does her mother understand she needs to express herself in thrash metal music?
Yeah, I think her mom does understand that. You know, her mom actually played guitar for a bit when she was younger. It was acoustic guitar, yeah, and it was more, you know, classical Arab music. But I think she understands her daughter's desire to play music. I don't think she likes metal as a genre, but she's open to it. And, you know, I think her number one desire is to keep her daughter safe and to make her a life for her daughter. And so if that's what, you know, her Lilas's skill is, and that's what her passion is, she's been very supportive of that.
So it would seem, given the situation in Lebanon and in Beirut, that thrash metal would be a natural expression of all the pent-up rage and frustration, right? And anger, right, at the government. And so what is there a lively, lively is kind of a weird word, but is there a big thrash metal or just metal scene in Lebanon?
Well, I definitely wouldn't call it big, but there used to be a dedicated community to metal, even since the 90s, when it was actually sort of criminalized, you know, to play heavy music in Lebanon. Since then, there has been a thriving community, but it's very small. And since the pandemic, unfortunately, and the economic decline in the country, the community has sort of been torn apart, and there just aren't venues to play. And I think people are just struggling to find their place. And a lot of people have relocated out of the country during that time.
Hmm. Well, the band does get an exciting opportunity early on in the film. They get an invitation to Glastonbury, the big music festival in the UK. And I guess, do they see that as their big break?
Yeah, I think, you know, especially because they were invited by a record label that signs bands just like them. So I think they did think they were going to, you know, have some sort of break. And, you know, it just really wasn't the break they thought they would get.
All right, everyone, give it up. Come on, bring the energy for Slave to the Siren. They've come a long way to be here with you today. So pick it up for them.
So then the camera pans over to the crowd, and it was so sad. At first there were, I guess, fewer than 10 people there. A few trickle in, but they don't get a crowd at all. What was that like for them?
Well, I think it was, you know, a bummer to not have more people watching them. But, you know, it's tricky when you're at the lower, you know, tier band on a giant festival. They put you in these slots. It's like high noon, you know, so everyone's hung over from the night before, and who's going to come watch a band at high noon outside? But, you know, at the end of the performance, they've drawn like many more people, and people are really into it. And they actually played really well, and they played their hearts out. So I felt that, you know, it was an important scene to include in the film, because that's the struggle of bands, more so today than ever, you know, just struggling to get your music out there and show what you can do.
So did anything come of that performance?
Not really, you know. I mean, they sort of went home and resumed life as usual.
So what now for them? It's been a few years since you filmed them, and where are they now?
So Alma, the bassist, has moved to Florida. Lilas and Sherry are still in Beirut. And the other two members, Maya, the vocalist, and Tatiana, the drummer, have actually left the band, unfortunately. Hmm. You know, life has just sort of taken turns for all of them, and they're just unable to continue committing to it. So the rest of the members, Lilas, Sherry, and Alma, are still Slave to Sirens, and now they're looking for a new vocalist and a new drummer.
And they will stay in Beirut?
Well, they're looking at their options. You know, I think they'd like to go abroad and see new things and experience new things in their life. Lilas wants to continue her studies in music. And, you know, there's a lot of interest in them. They have guitar sponsorships now and, you know, management labels have reached out, but they're just still in this sort of in-between stage with their band. So I think more opportunities will come once they've been able to secure new members, and their album is almost finished. They just need to record the vocals.
That's great. I wish them all the luck in the world, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Rita Baghdadi, filmmaker and director of the new documentary Sirens. It'll play at the Lemley Royal beginning this Friday. Okay, that'll do it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow. Rock on!